It's a magic wardrobe. There's a wood inside it, and it's snowing, and there's a fawn, and a witch, and it's called Narnia. Come and see. The image of something bigger on the inside than the outside is the metaphor right at the heart of the Narnia stories. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe begins by introducing us to that extraordinary idea. An idea which, it has to be said, has served its turn since then in science fiction, as all lovers of Doctor Who will recognise. But it's appropriate that the same metaphor is used again in The Last Battle, the final book in the Narnia sequence, and used in a very particular, and in some ways, even more imaginatively powerful way. The Last Battle, as I've mentioned before, is in a way the story of the Antichrist. It's the coming of a kind of trivial, degraded imitation of the truth, exploited by those who want power and profit. And the ape who is displaying Puzzle the donkey in his lion skin as if he were Aslan, summons the talking beasts and his own new allies from Calamine, the historic enemy of Narnia, to an assembly on Stable Hill. On the top of Stable Hill is an old, rather tumble-down stable. In that stable is concealed the false Aslan. And the ape, in the firelight outside, begins to explain to the population of Narnia that things are going to be very different from now on. Well, as things turn out, the stable, like the wardrobe, is the gateway into another world. The Last Battle reaches its climax with the great catastrophe that overwhelms Narnia. Those who are left in Narnia flood through the stable door to meet Aslan. And we are told each one looks him in the face, and some of them run in terror, and some of them walk towards him, often in terror as well. But once you're inside the stable, on the other side of that door, there is, much to the surprise of some of those who go through it, more of Narnia. Further up, further in, as you move more and more into the landscape on the other side of the stable door, you're not going into another world. You're going more deeply into Narnia. You discover it again and again. The landscape unfolds, the landscape you know, but somehow altered, somehow deeper, somehow inexhaustible. The inside of Narnia itself is bigger than the outside, because all reality is bigger on the inside than on the outside. To go in is not to retreat from the world, but to discover the true scope and scale of the world. Now, you're all thinking of how close that is to St. Augustine, I realise, and the way in which St. Augustine speaks of the great caves of the inner self, the caves of memory that lie within the mind. And Augustine's dictum, don't try to go outside for the truth. But, as C.S. Lewis reminds us, there's a bit of Plato in there as well. In The Last Battle, the three children have been reunited with Professor Kirk, Diggory, from the very first of the books. And he, in the time-honoured fashion of academics, says, it's all in Plato, all in Plato. Bless me, what do they teach them at these schools? He explains, When Aslan said you could never go back to Narnia, he meant the Narnia you were thinking of. But that was not the real Narnia. That had a beginning and an end. It was only a shadow or a copy of the real Narnia, which has always been here and always will be here. Just as our own world, England and all, is only a shadow or copy of something in Aslan's real world. And so what some people think of as Platonism, the idea that somehow this world is less real than another world, is rather turned on its head. This world is less real than this real world. What we are seeing and sensing is less, would it be wrong to say, less material, less actual, less vivid than its own inner self. It's like an onion, says another character, except that as you go in and in, each circle is larger. Everything is bigger on the inside. And so the journey inwards is not a journey away, but a journey towards what is most real in the reality you are already living in. You find just a touch of this in, to refer to it again, Lewis's science fiction story, That Hideous Strength, where one of the characters explains that every nation on Earth has a kind of platonic reality. It has some deeper truth about itself, some critical spiritual essence, which comes through in moments of great crisis. Lewis was writing That Hideous Strength at the end of the Second World War, and I shouldn't wonder if he had some idea in his mind that just something of that might have come through in the recent history he'd been part of. But it has to be said also that very typically of Lewis's method, one of the other characters immediately says, "You're exaggerating." Nonetheless, there is a foretaste in That Hideous Strength of this notion. And it relates very closely to what I hinted at the end of last night's lecture, which is a particular set of insights about what the process of human growth, and especially human spiritual growth, is like. But before we leave that image, it's worth again going to the final pages of The Last Battle for yet another extraordinary image which Lewis wants to leave us with. As the reunited friends, their Narnian allies, move more and more deeply into both England and Narnia at one and the same time, they realize that they are on one ridge of a whole range of mountains, all leading inwards. That country and this country, says Mr. Tumnus, the faun from The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, all the real countries are only spurs jutting out from the great mountains of Aslan. We have only to walk along the ridge, upward and inward, till it joins on. I doubt very much whether Lewis had come across the work of the great Byzantine theologian St. Maximus the Confessor. But that remarkable intellect of the 7th Christian century developed very richly the idea that everything that there is rests upon a word, a self-communication from God, the Word. And because all those words join on to the one word, all things find their coherence in that fact. All the mountains join on to the mountains of Aslan. Which means that in Aslan's country, all creation, including all persons, are in the process of becoming more and more themselves, not only discovering the unwelcome truths about themselves, as happens in your first encounter with Aslan, but actually becoming more true to Aslan's word. The implication of that is that the image of truth will grow as we grow. And that is made very clear to us in what's almost a throwaway moment in Prince Caspian, where Lucy is reunited after long separation with Aslan. She never stopped to think whether he was a friendly lion or not. She rushed to him. She felt her heart would burst if she lost a moment, and the next thing she knew was that she was kissing him and putting her arms as far around his neck as she could and burying her face in the beautiful, rich silkiness of his mane. "Aslan, Aslan, dear Aslan," sobbed Lucy, "at last." "Welcome, child," he said. "Aslan," said Lucy, "you're bigger." "That's because you are older, little one," he answered. "Not because you are." "I am not. But every year you grow, you will find me bigger." That in itself is an insight which we could well spend the rest of the evening, not to say the rest of the year, contemplating. And it tells us something that we've already seen hinted in so much of the description of Aslan. We cannot outgrow this reality, this truth. We can never be bigger than the truth that is leading us on. We can never exceed or compass or contain the love out of which we come. And so the more adult and sophisticated and wise we become, the more there is of Aslan to discover. Lewis is very deliberately pushing back here at the idea that faith is one of those things that you outgrow if you've got any sense. The image of truth grows as we grow and is always ahead of us. And that does also carry with it another insight into what we've already been thinking about in terms of the greater inside reality. Nothing is simply denied. What we've learned, what we've discovered, or what has discovered us, is always honored in Aslan's country, which is why it's possible for the earnest, devout young Calamine soldier in the last battle, who has worshipped and loved a false god all his life, finds in Aslan what he has actually been worshipping and loving. "Tash, the evil god of Calamine, is such that," says Aslan, "no service that is good can be done to him, but no service that is evil can be done to Aslan. All the good service done to the false god becomes service to Aslan." Nothing is simply denied. Nothing is simply lost. And so, what there is there before us to be contemplated, lived into, absorbed, to be absorbed by, never runs out. Again, in what's almost at first sight a throwaway moment, we have a glimpse of this once again in Lucy's experience in the voyage of the Dawn Treader, when she is in the magician's house, turning the pages of the magician's book. On the next page, she came to a spell for the refreshment of the spirit. The pictures were fewer here, but very beautiful, and what Lucy found herself reading was more like a story than a spell. It went on for 3 pages, and before she had read to the bottom of the page, she had forgotten that she was reading at all. She was living in the story as if it were real, and all the pictures were real too. When she had got to the third page and come to the end, she said, "That is the loveliest story I've ever read or ever shall read in my whole life. Oh, I wish I could have gone on reading it for 10 years. At least I'll read it over again." But here part of the magic of the book came into play. You couldn't turn back. The right-hand pages, the ones ahead, could be turned. The left-hand pages could not. "Oh, what a shame," said Lucy. "I did so want to read it again. Well, at least I must remember it. Let's see, it was about, it's all fading away again. And even this last page is going blank. This is a very strange book. How can I have forgotten? It was about a cup and a sword and a tree and a green hill. I know that much. But I can't remember. What shall I do?" And she never could remember. And ever since that day, what Lucy means by a good story is a story which reminds her of the forgotten story in the magician's book. A spell for the refreshment of the spirit, a cup and a sword and a tree and a green hill, and a story in which we are really involved, but we can't turn the pages back. I do not tell you what would have happened. But this is the story Aslan tells and will tell forever. Shall I ever be able to read that story again, the one I couldn't remember? Will you tell it to me, Aslan? Oh, do, do. Indeed, yes. I will tell it to you for years and years. But now come, we must meet the master of this house. The refreshment of the spirit, the discovery of oneself in a story that will take a lifetime to tell and to hear. A story which, as the last page of The Last Battle reminds us, never actually comes to an end. All their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now, at last, they were beginning chapter one of the great story which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before. Well, that's very wonderful. But here some of the difficulties arise, because at the end of The Last Battle, everybody is dead. And that has shocked some critical and fastidious readers. Not many successful children's books end with the death of all the main characters. Some critics have taken this as simply reinforcing the world-denying, negative, repressive qualities of the Narnia books. Though I don't think anyone who had really read them carefully could quite say that. But Lewis is not just killing off his characters because he's tired of them, or because someone's challenged him to do it, as according to the legend, Anthony Trollope went home after a dinner in his club where somebody had defied him to kill Mrs. Proudie and wrote her death scene in The Last Chronicle of Barset. No, Lewis is after something very positive and very significant here, which you could represent by saying that he's trying to demystify death. Now, as was noted last night, there's quite a bit of dramatic and violent death around in the books. They are, as I said last night, old-fashioned adventure stories with a strong intermixing of medieval chivalry. And that pre-modern adventure violence is part of the fabric of the books, which we can't unpick. Though it is worth noting, again, in passing, that it's not invariably glorified. And when, in the third chapter of The Last Battle, Tyrion and his unicorn friend, Jewel, slaughter some of the Calamines who are trying to take slaves away, they are ashamed of themselves afterwards. That's not quite how you do it. That's not really how you solve problems. But that does mean that, of course, death is part of the landscape to be accepted, just as it is in pre-modern adventure stories. When in Thomas Malory's stories about King Arthur and his knights, people adventure death, they mean it quite seriously. It's one of those things that's quite likely to happen. You become used to it, you risk it, and sometimes other people risk it with you, and that's the way the world is. Part of the landscape, yes. But much more significantly than that, one of the problems that we have to confront, that we have to be honest about, and we have to overcome, is our own urge to avoid death at all costs. Remember that in The Magician's Nephew, the wicked Queen Jadis, future Queen of Narnia, attains eternal life. She gets her heart's desire, and it is hellish. Now, in The Magician's Nephew, towards the end of the book, these themes are brought together in a very sharp and quite difficult way. It's yet another of those episodes that has caused offence to some readers. But it's worth pausing on it, just to get a fuller sense of what Lewis is about in speaking of death and life. Diggory, the little boy in The Magician's Nephew, has a very sick mother. He is, of course, terrified that she will die. Projected into Narnia by the incompetence of Uncle Andrew, caught up by his own folly and recklessness in the plots and schemes of Queen Jadis, he at last is confronted by Aslan in the passage which I read to you last night, and Aslan gives him a task to perform. He is to go to a garden on a hilltop at the far end of the world, and he's to pick an apple from the tree that he finds there. He is not to eat the apple, but he is to bring it back to Aslan. That's his task. In the garden, Queen Jadis is waiting for him. She knows all about what these apples can do. They give eternal life. And surely, if Diggory, instead of taking an apple to Aslan, takes it for himself, slips the magic ring back on his finger, goes back to his mother and gives her the apple, she will live. And Diggory is faced with a moral dilemma of proportions wholly unfair to any small boy. Diggory is taunted by the witch. Taunted in the words I quoted the other night, a wild animal in a strange world, which is none of your business. That's Aslan. Why should Aslan be trusted? Why should Aslan be served at the expense of the possibility of saving Diggory's mother's life? Fortunately, the witch rather overstates her case. She says nobody need ever know about this, and Polly, the little girl who is with Diggory, can safely be left behind and not taken back home to her world. At which point, Diggory begins to realize that the witch's world is perhaps not quite the generous moral one that you might want to inhabit. And miserably, stubbornly, he decides he must do what Aslan has asked him to do, and he takes the apple back to Aslan. I might just add in brackets that this particular depiction of a kind of tragic moral dilemma is something which I suspect Lewis took yet again from his reading of Thomas Malory's stories about King Arthur. Because in the stories of the Holy Grail, in Malory's great work, there are one or two instances where people are tested precisely by dilemmas of this kind. By doing the wrong thing, you can achieve the end you most desire. And you have to face the possible cost of not doing the wrong thing when it seems to entail disaster. Aslan eventually explains when Diggory brings the apple back. For once, I said last night I'd mentioned the exception to the general rule, for once Aslan does say something about what would have happened. If Diggory had taken the apple back, his mother would have lived, and she would have lived to regret the fact that she was alive. There is something that is worse than death, and that is the betrayal of self, truth, promise, faith. Breaking faith, breaking loyalty, breaks everything. And in fact, Diggory is indeed given an apple to take back to his world. His mother does recover. But what he has been through is an experience, a nightmare experience in some ways, of discovering what all of us dread to discover, that there may be something worse than the death of the body, and that is the death of faith or trust. Now, this doesn't mean that death is anything other than grievous. And once again, it's in The Magician's Nephew that we find this stated most poignantly. "Can't you give me something that will cure mother?" says Diggory to Aslan. Up till then, he'd been looking at the lion's great feet and the huge claws on them. Now, in his despair, he looked up at its face. What he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life, for the tawny face was bent down near his own, and wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared with Diggory's own that for a moment he felt as if the lion must really be sorrier about his mother than he was himself. My son," said Aslan, "I know. Grief is great. Only you and I in this land know that yet." Aslan and the human child have something in common, and it is grief. It is the awareness of loss and death. At that moment, they stand at the beginning of the life of Narnia, before sin, before catastrophe, before death. They, and they alone, know sorrow. A little more casually, at the end of The Silver Chair, the children witness on the far side of some kind of barrier King Caspian experiencing his resurrection. Eustace sees the revived Caspian, the revived and rejuvenated Caspian. Eustace made a step towards him with both hands held out, but then drew back with a somewhat startled expression. "Look here. I say," he stammered, "it's all very well, but aren't you, didn't you..." "Oh, don't be such an ass," said Caspian. "But," said Eustace, looking at Aslan, "hasn't he, died?" "Yes," said the lion in a very quiet voice, almost, Jill thought, as if he were laughing. "He has died. Most people have, you know. Even I have." Aslan in reminding Eustace that he, Aslan, has died. That is a key to a great deal going on at the end of that particular book, and even more in The Last Battle. Death is grievous. Sorrow is real. And on the far side of that, inside it, in its very depths, lies the intensification of life. On the far side of that journey inwards lies endless pleasure. There's an echo in that vision of the Screwtape Letters, one of Lewis's great masterpieces, the letters of advice from the elderly devil to the younger one, where the old devil, in exasperation, bursts out at one point. The trouble with the enemy, that is God, is that he's a hedonist. He believes in pleasure. All this nonsense about asceticism and self-denial, it's just a front. At the end of it all, he's only interested in pleasure. And so it is. Aslan's world is only about pleasure. A pleasure, a joy, that can only be arrived at by all the journeyings, the trials, the losses and the strippings that we've been examining. Those passages, especially at the end of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, are very evocative indeed here. You may remember that at the end of that book, when they have sailed to the utmost limits of the known world, they realize that they are on the frontiers of Aslan's country. And they're confronted by something like a huge wave, eternally suspended in the moment before it falls. A marvelous image. It's into that wave, of course, that Reepy Cheep sails, determined to get to Aslan's country, which he has wanted to see more than anything else. And they have a glimpse of what's beyond, a country that for a moment they can see but can't yet inhabit. Lewis, who is always particularly good at evoking dreamlike landscapes, excels himself here. The great wave is poised. All around them the sea is covered with shining lilies. And suddenly, there came a breeze from the east, tossing the top of the wave into foamy shapes and ruffling the smooth water all round them. It lasted only a second or so, but what it brought them in that second, none of those three children will ever forget. It brought both a smell and a sound, a musical sound. Edmund and Eustace would never talk about it afterwards. Lucy could only say, "It would break your heart." "Why?" said I. "Was it so sad?" "Sad? No," said Lucy. No one in that boat doubted that they were seeing beyond the end of the world into Aslan's country. Now that's followed immediately in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader by another very striking passage. Striking because it's perhaps the most direct biblical reference that Lewis offers in any of the Narnia books. They sail, or rather, I beg your pardon, they walk along the shore under the looming wave until they came to a flat place covered with short grass where the sky seems to come down to meet the earth. And between them and the foot of the sky, there was something so white on the green grass that even with their eagle's eyes they could hardly look at it. They came on and saw that it was a lamb. "Come and have breakfast," said the lamb in its sweet, milky voice. Then they noticed for the first time that there was a fire lit on the grass and fish roasting on it. They sat down and ate the fish, hungry now for the first time for many days. And it was the most delicious food they had ever tasted. The lamb, the breakfast on the shore. It's the fourth gospel. It's the risen Christ. The resurrection is the doorway into the new land. The lamb and the fish grilling on the fire. Underneath the great poised wave that never falls. It's the hinge between this world and Aslan's country. The resurrection meeting, the resurrection reality, which is the doorway. But of course there is one other strong biblical allusion, and you all have already picked it up. In those scenes in the last battle around Stable Hill. I want to turn last to the stable on the hill. Against all probability, this place, which apparently is where Aslan's imitation of the false god lives, has become the doorway into Aslan's own country. And unsurprisingly, it's Lucy, as usual, who gets the point. On the far side of the stable door, they're comparing notes about how they all came through and what a surprise it was to find it was bigger on the inside than the outside. "It seems then," said Tyrion, smiling himself, "that the stable seen from within and the stable seen from without are two different places." "Yes," said the Lord Diggory, "its inside is bigger than its outside." "Yes," said Queen Lucy, "in our world too, a stable once had something inside it that was bigger than our whole world." It was the first time she had spoken, and from the thrill in her voice, Tyrion now knew why. At last, the imagery of the inside that is greater than the outside is linked decisively to the central vision of the Christian faith, the central vision of the incarnation, that is, the created earthly shape within which is inexhaustible reality, the stable which holds the mystery that the worlds cannot contain. And you may very well think of John Donne's great address to the Virgin Mary, mentioning eternity cloistered in thy dear womb. And once you've understood that this imagery of inside and outside is at the heart of what the Christian faith proclaims, you realize it's the key not only to the incarnation and to the sacraments and to the church. Ponder a little on what it means to say that the church is bigger on the inside and the outside. But also a key to how we're to understand the soul and the body, and so human destiny. There are Christian theologians who across the centuries have pointed out the great error of saying that the soul is inside the body, whereas the truth is that the body is inside the soul. So we end with perhaps some understanding of why that imagery acts almost as a pair of bookends with the Narnia stories, the wardrobe and the stable, the landscape greater on the inside than the outside. Because that is the paradox of the whole relation of creation to its creator, of the incarnate Jesus to the everlasting and eternal Word. The clue to the paradox that we as human beings are greater on the inside than the outside. So, to sum up, Narnia helps us to see at least three things about the Christian faith. And I drop the evasion and ambivalence and speak not simply of Aslan, but of God. Narnia helps us to see God as if for the first time, to understand afresh what it's like to live in a world where God is alive and active, and to see transcendence not as mystique, as distance, as vagueness, but to see transcendence itself as wildness, the wildness of joy, a revolution against our own self-oppression, our own self-limiting. The truth of God is a revolution against what we have made of ourselves, a revolution we can never bring off for ourselves because we are so in love with, so defensive of, our falsehoods. And we can only be dealt with by that wild celebration, which is God, or Aslan. And Narnia helps us then, secondly, to see the root of all this in our inability to tell our own stories truthfully. The inability which means we have to be told our stories in the presence of love. And it helps us, thirdly, to see our own immediate experience of ourselves and our world as capable of opening up infinitely once we see it as all connected to eternal life, eternal action, eternal giving. When we see all that there is around us and within us as spurs from the mountains of Aslan. Now, the books have other themes, of course. How salvation works and what it means. Echoes and insights about what it means to think of God as Trinity. The nature of creation and how creation is making a reality that makes itself, that becomes itself creative. All of these are there at different points in the books. And there would be plenty of opportunity for more exploration of them. But what I've been trying to suggest in these three evenings is simply some of the main ways in which C.S. Lewis helps us sense afresh what it might be like to be a Christian, as if we'd forgotten. Because the truth is, a lot of us have. And maybe, as we read Narnia, something of the experience can be ours that Aslan promises to the children at the end of the voyage of the Dawn Treader. You and your brother will never come back to Narnia. Oh, Aslan, said Edmund and Lucy in despairing voices. You are too old, children, said Aslan. You must begin to come close to your own world now. It isn't Narnia, you know, sobbed Lucy. It's you. We shan't meet you there. And how can we live never meeting you? But you shall meet me, dear one, said Aslan. Are you there too, sir? Said Edmund.
I am, said Aslan.
But there I have another name. You must learn to know me by that name. This was the very reason why you were brought to Narnia. That by knowing me here for a little, you may know me better there. As before, we have about 10 or 15 minutes for questions, and the roving mic is here. If you'd like to stand up when you ask a question, thank you.
Hmm.
Where are the 21st century Lewises?
Yes. To be honest, I don't see very much sign of it at the moment in the kind of literature that Lewis is attempting. And part of me wonders whether in the last part of the 20th century that particular vein of fantasy, children's fantasy, other worlds and so forth, hasn't been worked so hard that it's almost in danger of getting stale. You know, some people have attempted similar parallel world fantasies. Nobody's quite brought it off, I think, in the same way. So I'm not terribly sanguine about seeing any new Narnias certainly in children or young adults literature at the moment. But I suspect that there may be other ways in which the literary imagination can present the Gospels afresh. And this isn't about children's literature, but like, I guess, many people in this audience, I found in the novels of Marilyn Robinson, Gilead and Home, an imagination which actually makes the Christian gospel seriously new and challenging. And I, reviewing one of her books once, I quoted from an extremely unlikely journalistic comment on her. It's a comment by someone who was wholly secular and rather macho and very impatient with religion and sensitivity and all those things, who simply said, "Marilyn Robinson shows how Christianity might actually, after all, be something that helps you think." Now, that's quite a tribute. So we do have some people who are, for our age, refreshing, renewing what otherwise is stale, but I'm not sure I see it very readily yet in literature for younger people. We'll see. Thank you very much. Astrology, yes. Just a note first for those who haven't come across it. There is a most impressive book by Michael Ward, Peterhouse College in Cambridge, demonstrating that the seven Narnia books, in their imagery and some of their plotting, do seem to embody the medieval idea of the seven planetary powers. Each of the planets of the Middle Ages had, as it were, attached to itself a certain set of qualities or images or associations. And it's perfectly true that if you look at the Narnia books, you do seem to see that kind of resonance. And that makes perfect sense. Lewis was fascinated by medieval astrology. However, and it's a big however, what he sees in medieval astrology is a very sophisticated system of symbols allowing you to make some sense of how metaphors cluster or assemble around certain focal images. So, for example, if you're talking about the planetary influence of Saturn, which is what Michael Ward finds in The Last Battle, then there will be images of metallic colour, of greyness, There will be melancholy of a certain kind. There will be a sense of endings. And similarly, if you're writing about the planetary influence of Jupiter, then everything that we mean by jovial and a great deal more will come into play. The colours of bright scarlet and gold, the sense of great spiritedness, not high spirits in the usual sense, but what the medievals and others meant by being magnanimous, great-souled, generosity, extravagance. So the planetary influences there work in that kind of way. Lewis probably half believed, and I choose my words carefully, half believed that there was something in the medieval idea that our personalities were shaped by the star signs we were born under. Half believed that, because the medievals believed it. What Lewis didn't believe, and what no sensible Christian has ever been able to believe, is that there is some kind of predictive science in astrology, because, of course, that would mean that our futures were determined and we have free will. St. Augustine, second time tonight, St. Augustine mentions in his Confessions how he first became skeptical about the claims of some astrologers in his own time, because it was obviously perfectly possible that two identical twins born under the same star sign would have entirely different biographies. That was just a matter of experience. It was obvious. So Lewis would have had no time whatever for looking at your horoscope in the newspaper, no patience whatever with fortune-telling, however sophisticated. He would have wondered a bit, and wondered sympathetically, whether there was something in all this business about the particular constellation of the heavens at the time of your birth which shaped some of your possibilities. But I don't think he'd have been on oath about that. And speaking for the Church of England, which of course I do all the time, I think I'd be very much with Lewis. The notion that something about the date of our birth shapes our possibilities, well, that's intriguing. I've no idea what it would really mean. But I can't see that we ought to have any truck whatever with the notion that, in Shakespeare's words, the stars above us govern our condition in the sense of actually blocking our choices for us. I don't think any Christian can really hold that. I don't know whether I'll find the courage to ask anybody in the royal household next week whether they've chosen the date of the royal wedding after consulting the court astrologers. Have we any more? Yes, there's somebody there. Would you stand, please? I'm sorry. What's my favourite book? Of the Narnia books or just generally?
Narnia.
Well now, difficult. I mean, I reread them all with great enthusiasm. You might have noticed that I quoted The Voyage of the Dawn Treader quite a bit. Not just because I saw the film at Christmas and liked it, but because actually I find some of the most really memorable pictures and episodes are in that book. Lucy in the Magician's House, Eustace and the Dragon, and of course that amazing sequence at the end when they're all coming towards Aslan's country. So I think I might say The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. One more, I think. Yes.
Well, yeah. Well, thank you for your generosity. I do have this day job, as you, as I think you've noticed. But I, given time, I would very much like to pursue the exploration, because, as I said last night, I find so much of my own faith is filled out and refreshed by these books that I'd like to share it. And I think Lewis deserves the tribute of that sort of exploration. So who knows, one day I'll do my best. I think we probably ought to break at this point for people to leave who want to, but may I just say thank you very much to all of you for being here these three evenings, and wish you well with your own exploration of these themes in the future. Thank you very much.